All right, welcome back to Film Shake. This is episode 3.5, where we'll be getting into the spoilers for Akira Kurosawa's Dreams. I'm Jordan.
I'm Nick.
Nick, good to have you back, as we just recorded our hour-long conversation that we're going to cut down to 30 minutes. But now we can, you know, branch out and stretch our legs and talk about whatever the hell we want to talk about.
That's right. Speaking of hell, whenever I said I'm Nick in that aggressive manner, I couldn't help but think I just watched something the other day. You know, old Nick is an old kind of folk tale name for Satan.
Old Nick?
Like, yeah. Old Nick.
Little Nicky? Know.
Yeah. Like little Nicky. Sandler movie? Yeah, that's where it comes from, is old Nick. Not okay. Old Saint Nick.
Not old Saint Nick.
Like
Nick.
Satan. So, I almost said I'm Satan. Thankfully, I did not. I said, I'm Nick.
Yeah, we don't want that.
Yeah.
Be gone. but there is a lot of hellish elements to this film. And I think in particular to the two scenes we're going to talk about for the Eye of the Duck segment.
Yes.
So this is where we kind of go off of David Lynch's coined term, Eye of the Duck, which is the jewel of a film, just like the eye of a duck is the jewel of the animal or something like that. We're not quite sure what he's talking about.
The first time we did this, you were very certain of its meaning, and you've grown less and less certain the more just, that we talk about
just
it.
Just like watching a David Lynch movie.
Exactly. I thought I knew what Mulholland Falls meant.
Basically, this is the key scene of the movie. I know what I'm talking about. I'm just not quite sure he does. But anyway, I like David Lynch. Anyway, so yeah, we're going to talk about what we believe are the key scenes or the key scene of this film. So, Nick, I'll let you go first. What did you think was the key scene of Dreams?
Okay, so chronologically, mine comes after yours.
Or should I go first?
So you go first.
Okay. So to me, we talked a little bit about this in the spoiler-free episode. So go check that out if you haven't listened to it, episode 3. But in the segment Mount Fuji in Red, which I didn't say this before, but I did think the effects in this were a little hokey and a little cheesy, but you know, it kind of goes into the artifice and the kind of fakeness of some of these settings, of some of these vignettes that we get into. But anyway, that threw me out of it a little bit. And like I said, the heavy-handedness of the message here. But I did think it was really kind of poignant that he ends that vignette with the man swinging at the air with his coat, trying to shield the woman and her children in that moment from the radioactive vapors that are blowing all
That's
around
right.
them.
Both amazing and ridiculous at the same time.
Yeah, it's kind of hilarious, but so tragic in just depicting man's futility and again, there's this environmental aspect where this is what we have done to our beloved Earth. Look how much we have destroyed something that's so beautiful.
Yes.
And now we're suffering the consequences.
And we've worked our way up here in the vignettes from just a child intruding in the forest in a manner he doesn't understand to a peach orchard getting chopped down to men dying in war to we're going to end the world with our actions. This is the sixth vignette that right. Your Eye of the Duck is from. So we've built up to this throughout the movie.
Right. So this is almost kind of like a climax or, top of the hill moment where everything that we've built up to is just coming, kind of crashing down literally from the volcano onto all the people who've jumped into the sea and killed themselves. There's a nice commentary here about how even if they did live on, the radiation would kill them eventually, and that's no life to live. So the businessman in this sense is just gonna jump off the cliff. We actually don't get to see that on screen. We cut back and he's gone, but we're left with the avatar for Kurosawa, whose character's name is I. He's the one swinging the jacket in futility, trying to shield this woman. So possibly noble intentions, but futile in the end.
Yes. And this kind of segs into the next vignette. I love how often I'm saying that word
segs.
Wrong. I'm never going to say the word correctly.
Vignette?
Yes.
I just like how you said segs.
Segs.
I like that verbiage there.
That's right. So we get to the next one. We're in the seventh one. This is the penultimate vignette of the film. So we find out that everyone did not die, if you want to take this chronologically, because...
Right. If you want to see this as like a progression from the last episode.
Exactly. The dreamer enters a landscape where this nuclear holocaust has already happened. It's happened years before. everything is completely desolate. Then he comes upon a man who, oh, I'm just going to spitball Japanese terms that I know and say maybe he's supposed to be an oni. I think that's a demon.
Right. He's got a horn on his head. He's all in rags.
That's right.
He's crazy looking.
He's acting real wacky. Mm-hmm. And there are 20-foot tall dandelions everywhere. And he basically explains to the dreamer and the viewer. I mean, it's an exposition dump.
Yeah.
But he explains, you know, these men, these businessmen, and these money-obsessed humans with no care for the environment have created a nuclear holocaust. And now, basically, in sort of a Dante-esque fashion, for the crimes they've committed, the worse the crimes they've committed environmentally, the worse their punishment is, and their punishment is basically determined by the amount of horns that sprout from their head. So these people, they're basically just rolling around and gnashing their teeth and screaming and crying. And it's sort of a reveal that reminded me of the landscape from 2001 A Space Odyssey, where you kind of see this primordial Earth, and you see, like primordial man hopping around and acting real primordial. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get the same kind of imagery where there's, you know, red smoke and everything's very barren and rocky.
But
and then,
did 2001 have pools of blood?
I don't think it did.
I don't think so. Correct me if I'm wrong. There weren't giant pools of
plenty
blood.
Plenty of Kubrick films do, but yes, not that one.
Yes.
So we see these this barren landscape, and the camera pulls away, and there are just all these monsters with horns sprouted out of their heads. It's humans with horns sprouted out of their heads who've now become demons, and they're all rolling around on the ground in pain, screaming.
Very dramatic, very over the top.
Extremely over the top. It's the kind of scene that if you saw it when you were a child, you would likely be terrified. But as an adult, it kind of does something that he does often, where the camera stays on them probably longer than it needs to.
Right.
He really wants to get this point across. But I also kind of think that it's the point of the film, which is this: if we continue to intrude into nature and to put our own greed first before the earth and our own maybe spiritual health, if we put our greed before that, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, I like how the first oni or the demon says that the men who were successful in their previous life, who were ambitious and who, you know, were power hungry, are also the leaders in this post-apocalyptic hell world. You know, so these men that have all the horns are supposedly the leaders of this world, but yet he juxtaposes that with, all right, when the dusk comes and, you know, it's nighttime, they start feeling these sharp pains in their horns, and that's the howling and the writhing that we see. But yeah, we talked a little bit about the pageantry of some of the other vignettes with the doll ceremony and at the end, and the fox wedding, and at the end we'll talk about the funeral there. This almost had a pageantry play-like aspect to it, first in that scene where our dream traveler and the first demon are talking, and then there's just this wide shot where there's lots of exposition and the demon's just kind of explaining the world to us. So it almost feels like we're looking at a very static play moment there, mm-hmm. or we're just having dialogue. And then the acting of the men and women, I'm guessing were there women, the people with horns?
I believe there were women. Okay.
So the men and women in the pit with the blood, with the horns, all the screaming and crying out. It was very over the top, very dramatic.
Yeah,
so
the audio is highly amplified.
Right. So it again feels kind of like a more nightmarish pageantry, but there's definitely like almost some play-like aspects. And Kurosawa in other films, and in this film particularly, does call back the Japanese no. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The no play, or N-O-H is, yes, how you spell it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's calling attention to, you know, that Japanese culture and tradition as well. So there's a lot of that going on there.
Most definitely. And this is where the film reminds me of an older film that's also composed of a lot of shorter films or vignettes. I haven't seen it in a long time. I loved it when I was a kid. And that's Walt Disney's Fantasia. Walt Disney's Fantasia. It's been so long. When I was a kid, I didn't notice a narrative through line through the movie. There's probably not one, but I don't know. I need to watch it again, because I loved it when I was a kid. And I love classical music
right.
as a boy. I mean, I still do, but I listen to it almost exclusively. So that movie really brought together a lot of my interest. But as far as the actual tone and feeling of the movie, he does, the film does come to this climax that's very nightmarish. It's A Night on Bald Mountain, you know, where it's basically this black mass with this terrifying, horrifying imagery, which of course I loved. I mean, it's a really, really awesome, well-animated scene. But it is nightmarish, and it's very similar to this, where you get this dark, sort of evil, horrifying imagery that's really over the top, and then is followed by, in the film, it's followed sort of by this Christian mass where these monks come and chant and bring on the morning from the night, and everything is peaceful and serene. And much like that, the eighth vignette here takes place in a peaceful village in modern times. And this is sort of our spoiler for the movie, because this really reveals his intentions if you haven't picked up, you know,
all the other themes. Yeah,
that's right. It's a village that's rejected technology. They've gone back to an older way of living.
The water mills.
With the water mills. And I believe that's Village of Water Mills is the name of the vignette.
Yeah, it's the title of this section. Yeah.
That's right. So we really get sort of another exposition dump where the dreamer talks to this old man who sort of espouses the philosophy of the village and that they live in harmony. And I mean, it's over the top and very blatant. There's no subtlety. But I mean, I loved it. He's got lines like, night is supposed to be dark.
I like that line.
You're supposed to be able to see the stars, which I told my wife that like a decade ago when we were living in a really rural area and she wanted to get a street light. Mm-hmm. That was what I said back, which wasn't popularly received.
Yeah. I did really like that line. Like you said, it can be very heavy-handed there, and that's probably one of the most egregious moments for me, that whole speech that he gives our traveler. But I did really like that line, night is supposed to be dark, just kind of this simple renunciation of technology, like this is just how it's supposed to be, you know. So I did enjoy that.
That's right.
Did this almost feel like a paradise to you compared to the hellscape that we were in before? It's like from in the progression, you know, going from hell to heaven now?
Very much so. I kind of feel like he's saying this is what could be.
Right.
If we would turn around now, change our ways, this is what life could be like.
Yeah. This is his dream for the world.
It's right. It's not to say a dying man's dream, but he did make a couple more films, but he didn't live too much longer past this.
Yeah.
And this is kind of what his last wish for humanity. Live this way. Live in harmony with nature. And I also felt like this is almost a bit of a rebuke of Mizoguchi in a way, because with Mizoguchi, you see the stark reality of living things the old way. Mm. You know, there's things don't work out so well in those because of those older systems of living. You know,
he's more progressive. He wants things to change.
Exactly.
Kurosawa is more looking to the past and maybe idealizing it a little bit more. I mean, he makes tons of films, you know, set in the Meiji era and the, you know, older periods of time with samurai and different things. So I don't know if that plays into it here too, where we have a look back to an older way of living that is kind of idealized. And, you know, I kind of laughed tongue in cheek at that, because it's like, okay, well, if you reject electricity like this little village does, or you reject all technology, how are you gonna make your movies, bud?
Yeah, what you gonna film with? Are you gonna do it Flintstone style?
Right.
Gonna get a little bird to peck it out on some wood?
Yeah, but I mean, the point is very poetic though, and you know, it's simple message and it's a simple answer to, you know, a very complicated problem. But I did like, you know, I do agree with them. You know, I do like nature. I kind of like trees, you know. I kind of like going outside.
I can buy into this thing.
Yeah, I can kind of buy the environmentalism here. No, and it is a peaceful and idyllic way of life. So, you know, how realistic is it for like a solution to, you know, the energy problems of the world? I don't know if he's necessarily saying that here, but it is just kind of a quiet look into a very idealized paradise.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to forget to say, because we talked about how the beginning and the end of the films kind of mirror each other. There's a funeral here, but
it's a joyous occasion
because everyone who lives there lives well,
right,
and has accomplished what they have, you know, done. And now they're going to rejoin the earth. which we got the fox wedding earlier in the film.
Right, which was very forbidden, very ominous.
Yes, so it's almost shameful for the boy to have witnessed it. But here it's a celebration, and much like that he probably stays on it too long. And
yeah, it stays on a little too long. Yeah,
maybe two or 3 minutes less of the funeral would have been okay.
Yeah, been okay with that.
I thought those scenes were beautiful.
Yeah, and you kind of feels too long, but you almost feel like it couldn't be any other way. So I did like the simple setup of where, again, talking a little bit about the no plays in Japanese tradition. Apparently in those plays, again, not super familiar with that tradition, but reading a little bit about it, in those plays, you typically would have a traveler who comes to a town and then meets a local person that then tells them about that town or that tells them a story. So just like
Dogville.
Just like Dogville. But we have that here. You see that same kind of thing all throughout, you know, especially like in the Weeping Demon, the demon's kind of explaining the situation to I, the traveler. And then here you have the same thing. So I thought that was interesting reading about it. But what I was going to say, I do like the simple setup of he's at the beginning of this vignette, the traveler sees the rock and the flowers that the children are placing on the rock, and he notices that and he's interested. Then he asks the old man about that, and the old man tells him the story about a traveler who came and who got sick and died on that spot. And so they honored him and put that rock there as kind of like a tombstone. And that was years and years ago. And the tradition has continued to put flowers on the rock, but people nowadays do it not even really knowing the history of that. And that was a nice touch there with this man who's 103 years old. He knows this whole village's history, and yet some of the people here don't really know why they do that, but it's a tradition. I thought it was a nice little touch. But then that sets it up for the end, beautiful last shot, where the traveler is about to leave town, and he goes and picks some flowers, and he places them on the rock, honoring the traveler who had fallen there years back, and then he walks off, looks and ponders the river and the water mills for a while, and then he walks off screen. And then we have that nice credit shot of the river and the weeds underwater. So
it's beautiful, but unfortunately, after all the Mizuguchi we've watched, I was seasoned to expect that when he knelt down to put the flowers on the unknown grave, that a group of cavalry soldiers, samurai soldiers with swords, were going to drive by and slash his throat and then burn down the village and sell all of the inhabitants into slavery.
Or at least for the camera to pan up.
That's right. The pan up, yeah.
The pan up, yeah, that from Mizuguchi.
Really, the end credit, I kind of dig, which you don't see this a lot anymore, but it happened more, I feel like, really in 70s movies a lot, if the credits didn't happen at the beginning of the film. That at the end of the film, you kind of get imagery behind the credits.
Right.
And I really enjoyed that imagery, the reeds and the water.
The reeds and the water, yeah. And again, this is something I read, didn't come up with on my own, but each vignette talks a little bit about death, and especially here we have the funeral and the man, you know, he doesn't stay in town, he leaves, and the camera, talking about the camera not panning up to see the sky or any, you know, beautiful landscapes off in the distance, it stays down and then it cuts and even points down to the river. So one thing that I read about was how, you know, the sky is for the living, and the, you know, we have a lot of moments within the film of the sky and things floating in the air, the crows,
the sky being poisoned,
the sky being poisoned, things going on in the air. And, you know, of course, Kurosawa's got to have rain. He's got to have some sort of precipitation, the snow, all those things. But here the lens points to the ground, to the river, and to what's underneath. So maybe symbolic for death there, being buried, and but kind of like a beautiful poetic death. More contentment in death, I think.
You know, it really got me emotionally. I wrote down, I'm giving this a 10 out of 10.
You are?
But then
you're moving up?
Oh, well, no, but because then I reflected then on the movie. You know, I don't, that's why I'm glad we don't do these right after we watch the movie,
right?
Because I'll get emotionally tied into things I'm watching, and then I have to think about it later and be like, okay, logically, what was really going on? Okay, so I just got wrapped up in my emotions at the end.
Yeah.
That part was awesome. But the whole movie was not perfect.
Yeah, it had some flaws, but
which we spoke about in the non-spoiler right. show.
Yes, it's definitely worth a shot though. So if you've listened to all this by now and still haven't seen it, you should definitely give it a shot. It's an interesting film at the end of a great filmmaker's life, and it's different from a lot of other stuff that he's done. I did have one question that we'll maybe mix back into the middle of this thing.
Hit me with your shot.
When reading about the blizzard scene, there is a supernatural element there where these men are traveling through the blizzard and then they're all falling asleep. What I read was that the snow fairy, or that the woman that appears, mm-hmm. is apparently and I've read, I guess, conflicting accounts. One thing that I read was that the snow fairy appears, is trying to aid the man in helping him overcome the tempest, overcome the blizzard, to give him strength and help him to wake up and pursue his journey and survive. The way I read it, and what other accounts that I've read was that this was a temptation, like a temptress who was tempting him
to
sleep.
She tells him the snow is warm.
The snow. To me, I read that like she's tricking him.
That's what I thought too. Right. Lay down in this warm snow and he'll be cozy, and she's trying to get him to die of hypothermia.
Exactly. That's how I read it. Like he's being tempted. She's like a representation of the snow and the alluring effect of the cold. Like he just wants to fall asleep there and just give up. And we even see like this kind of evil face on her as she's kind of repelled and flies away into the air.
Unmistakably.
So yeah, I felt like, okay, this is clearly, he doesn't give in, he pushes back, and she's repelled, and he overcomes this temptation.
Who thinks that she was good? Not Kurosawa wasn't intending that, right?
No, not in the Criterion.
Because if so, I've got to go back and watch all his movies.
No, not in the Criterion booklet that I read, or some of the other, deep reviews that I read about it. But there was like a couple other reviews and maybe a synopsis on IMDb that was, that was like, yeah, man, the man is saved by the supernatural force that comes out of nowhere to aid him or whatever. Yeah. It's like, no, that wasn't it. You got that wrong.
I've talked about this with a friend of mine who he lives in, he lives up north, Hyneal, if you're listening. We had this discussion. It was really late at night, so I don't know if you'll remember it, but I really feel like I have a tough time reading modern film criticism, because I do feel like a lot of times people are just cynically sitting in the theater with notes and with their cell phone, and they're not really paying attention and just taking it like a job. Mm-hmm. Because if you read film reviews, just click any random one on Rotten Tomatoes. If you attentively watch the film, you'll notice a lot of times they'll get simple plot details wrong, or they didn't understand it.
I see that a lot.
Where I don't think they were focusing on the movie. I think they were just trying to get the words down so they could get whatever payout they're getting for the review.
Yeah.
Which sadly isn't a lot now. But
I mean, to be honest, you see that even with some of the greats too. Like I've noticed that with Ebert as well, where he'll get like basic plot details wrong.
Ebert is perfect. He's never done anything wrong in his life.
He's a schmuck. No, I like Ebert, but that can be a problem with some of his stuff too.
Yeah.
But all that to say, Dreams, enjoyed it, gave it 4 out of 5. So you were tempted to give it 10 out of 10.
I had to see, I could go idealistically, but I'm not in that old man stage yet.
Yeah. You're not an old man yet.
That's right. I don't have an AARP subscription yet. So I'm going to have to be real here and give it a 9 out of 10. And I love the imagery. I think it's beautiful. I think it's a very personal film that doesn't alienate the viewer, which is often a problem with films that are very personal. I think it's a very welcoming and inviting film.
He could easily have gone that route too, with it being so intimate and about his dreams. I mean, how many times have you tried to tell somebody a dream that you had and they just don't care?
Yeah.
So that could have been this whole film.
Exactly. But, and it's not. Even though there are definitely moments where at least our attention wanes as viewers. Overall, it is a beautiful film. It's the work of an aging master, but it's still the work of a master.
Yeah, I did feel like it was surreal, yet it was intimate and personal, so there was a nice dichotomy there. It was startling, and I felt like it was alienating at times, but in a good way, because it was also beautifully haunting and poetic like a dream. So I felt like he did capture a lot of those dreamscapes and those that mindset you take coming out of a dream. It put me into that place. Like I said, it brought me out of it a little bit with some of the moralizing, but, you know, overall, I really did like it. I didn't love it like I did Sancho or some of the other Mizoguchi stuff.
Sancho was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, hands down.
That may end up in my top 10 with, you know, more rewatches.
We'll probably get into our favorite Kurosawa, I think, when we do our next episode. So we can talk, you know, at the end of that one, what was your favorite standout Kurosawa. But next time, episode 4, we're going to be talking about Ikiru, or To Live, from Akira Kurosawa. That's held up as one of his greats, so it's a blind spot for Nick and I. We need to just solve that problem. That's what really we're here to do a lot of times, just pick a movie we haven't seen yet that we know we should have. This is like our list of shame. So you're looking at some of the stuff we've watched and you're like, I saw that years ago. Well, sorry, buddy, we're just getting into it.
But that's right.
Yeah,
noobs.
We're noobs. We're trying our best here. No,
wow.
You know, we've seen that a lot of good stuff, but this that's is right. just some stuff that we need to solve and get off our watch list and move on. So
most definitely.
So next up, Ikiru. Check that out. We'll see you next time for more Film Shake.
Take it easy.
Walt Disney's
Fantasia.